Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Need you to find the very first verse of the Bible. Genesis 1:1 is where we're starting. Let's just get right in the text as we continue this morning with the worship of God. At this point in our worship, we are reverencing Him by listening to His Word. And I want to begin in His Word in Genesis chapter 1 and verse number 1. Read in the text with me, please. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I'm thinking for a moment about a group that I read, a small group on the campus of Virginia Tech University. It looks like any campus club with young people gathering after a day of classes. But pretty quickly, there's a sense of quiet in the talk, almost something there, secret, something they don't want people to know. In fact, a shy young woman says, "My closest friends know, but where I come from, no one is like me. I can't tell my parents about this." Others nod sympathetically. They too say that they're afraid to go public. They're afraid to come out. What are we talking about? Maybe we're talking about a meeting of the gay and lesbian club? No. What I'm talking about on Virginia Tech's campus is the meeting of atheists and agnostics. If things continue as they are, it won't be very long, I don't think, until these students can loudly and proudly announce that they don't believe in God. In 2007, there were only about 100 of those kinds of clubs on university campuses, but now, just some 8 years later, there are more than 350. And I think that is reflecting a shift in American demographics, particularly with a younger generation. One survey found that more than a third of Americans age 18 to 29 say they have no religious affiliation. Not hard to imagine. With the constant assault on faith, all the stuff that these famous atheists like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins are constantly stirring up, and their books rising to the tops of bestseller lists, the relentless attacks upon Christianity and the belief in God that seem to be everywhere around us. How long until that one-third of those 18 to 29-year-olds with no religious identification become one-third who say, "I don't believe in God at all"? Right now, there's a stigma, particularly in the South, with saying, "Hey, I'm an atheist." But stigmas change, don't they? Used to be a stigma associated with living together before you were married. Used to be a stigma associated with being openly homosexual. Those things changed. In our society as well, one wonders how long until people gladly announce, "I don't believe in God." What we're talking about this morning is a battle for the very existence of the Lord. And so as we think about certainty in an age of doubt, what we do need to talk about is the very existence of God. How do you know God exists? The Bible begins with the Lord. That's the text that we just read. The Bible does not make a specific and explicit case for the belief in the existence of God. Although, as we'll see this morning, it references and helps us with those ideas again and again. It's important for us to know that without the belief in God, the Bible's finished where it starts. So this matter of God's existence needs to matter, doesn't it? And I want to be very clear. While it is alarming to see how much attention atheists get today, they seem like they're on the television, every news show, whenever they want to be. I need to be clear. Atheism's got a long way to go if it wants to capture America. Every poll shows, every survey shows that Americans overwhelmingly believe in God. In fact, every survey shows that a vast majority of people accept God and believe in a personal God. But in our world today, everything is up for debate. And that does include God's existence. Atheists regularly ridicule the idea of faith. They announce that Christians are ignorant and backward, that in fact we're holding society back. We are told that science and religion are locked in a struggle to the death, and that science is going to win, which means Religion's going to die. You ready for that? We can talk about a campus meeting on Virginia Tech's campus, but really this morning, that doesn't matter. What matters is what you believe. Do you believe in God? And even more, do you know why you believe in God? If a friend, if your child, if a coworker asks you, how do you know God exists? What would you say about that? Do you know why you believe what you believe? As we're thinking about that this morning, let's just say a word or two about whether it really matters what you believe. Because what's become very popular any time we make any appeal to reason discourse today is for people to just kind of shrug and say, whatever. You know, you believe what you want to believe. I'm going to believe what I want to believe. It doesn't really make any difference what you believe. You just do your thing. I'm going to do my thing. Doesn't really matter. Never has anything been any wider of the mark than to suggest for a moment that where we stand on the existence of God just isn't that important. Let me suggest to you this morning three reasons why it's absolutely important. Let's just start by saying we're discussing here who's on the top. Who's number one? Are we saying that human beings are the supreme being? That there's nothing above us, nobody above us. We're in charge. We're large and in charge. Nobody calls us into account. We answer for nobody. If there is no supreme being, then that is exactly where we are. And of course, that's going to affect our behavior. If there is no God, who says what's right? Who says what's wrong? Who says what you ought to do and what you ought not to do? Maybe Hitler got it right. The way to do things is to mow people down who are in your way, climb over them to get what you want. Who is to say otherwise if we're just animals after all? In fact, all of that is to say then, we need to ask the question about the whole purpose of life. Why are we here and what are we doing? If there is no God, then how can life have any real meaning? Could you find Acts 17? This is the appeal that Paul is making in Acts 17. In Acts 17, as he talks to the people of Athens who were polytheists, he identifies the purpose of life is to know the real God. So he says in Acts 17, in Acts 17, verse 26, he made from one man, Acts 17, 26, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward Him and find Him. Yet He's actually not far from us. Our purpose in life is to know the Lord. If there is no God, then there is really no meaning, especially since we're all going to die and eventually bump into nothingness. In fact, the famous French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said the following, I was thinking that here we are and we're eating and drinking to preserve our precious existence and that there's nothing, absolutely no reason for existing. That's what atheism gets you. Tell me again, it doesn't matter. It absolutely matters. What we believe about God determines everything that we do and who we are from that point forward. Which is why this morning I want to share with you four undeniable proofs of the existence of God. I should say that I do not believe there is any proof that will force someone to believe in God. But the proofs that I will set forth before you this morning absolutely show that it is reasonable, intelligent, and makes sense to believe in God. I want to say this. There are some very compelling philosophical arguments for the Lord, but that can get to be some pretty deep water in a hurry. What I want to share with you this morning is just some simple truths, some very clear ideas that are accurate, biblical, scriptural, and that just make sense. And I think these four ideas form a core that we can stand on, that we can depend upon, that give us reason for our faith. I think these ideas are easy to understand and easy to share with others. Let me give you four undeniable proofs for the existence of God. Let's just start in the book of Hebrews. I want to look in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4. In Hebrews chapter 3 and in verse 4. In Hebrews 3 and 4, as I said at the outset, the Bible does not make an explicit, specific case for the existence of God, but it certainly references these ideas all along. This is a good illustration of that. In Hebrews 3 and in verse 4, the Hebrew writer says, "For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God." Every house is built by somebody. That's the law of cause and effect. Every house has a builder. We all understand the law of cause and effect. If you were walking through the woods and you found a watch laying there in the leaves and the grass, no one, and I mean no one, would say, "Well, look at that. That just popped into being out of nothingness, perfectly assembled, keeping absolutely flawless time. Isn't that just amazing? I'm so glad that that watch just came into existence." No. We know that there is a cause for that effect. Somebody caused that watch. Even a 4-year-old will say, "Daddy, someone lost their watch." And that is exactly what the Hebrew writer is saying. Every house has a designer. So we are living in a huge house called the universe. That is a giant effect. I want to know what is the cause for that effect. In elegant philosophical terms, here's the question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Who caused all of this? Now, atheists want to argue nobody caused it. It just popped into being. So, for example, Stephen Hawking, a very famous atheist, said, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing. We're supposed to take that seriously? Anybody really believe that? If a fellow didn't say it who had a whole bunch of PhDs and the media anointed as being really important, something came from nothing? Really? Can you imagine mom saying to their teenage son, "Johnny, how did these cigarettes get in your jacket pocket?" "Well, you know, mom, the laws of science say that even though there was nothing in my pocket, those cigarettes were just spontaneously creating themselves." Really? No one's buying that. What comes from nothing? Nothing comes from nothing. What do you mean because of the laws of gravity, the universe will spontaneously create itself? If there's nothing, there's no law of gravity. And there's nothing, then what you have, don't let me get too deep here, is nothing. Nothing comes from nothing. Now, let me make a quick note here. You run this out with an atheist, and they're going to say, "Oh, cause and effect. Okay, what caused God? What caused God? That sounds really smart. And that may give you pause. You should know that's just the atheist attempt to say, "Squirrel!" so that you'll be distracted from their complete lack of ability to explain our universe. It's actually not the right question. When you're dealing with the law of cause and effect, you're dealing with what? You're dealing with nature and natural phenomena. All things natural, like our universe, have a cause, have an effect. All of that works in nature. But there are many things for which you can't ask the question of, "Well, what caused that? What caused blue? What caused love? What caused liberty? What caused the number 4? See, there are lots of things that are outside of cause and effect. Ideas, for example, are beyond those sorts of things. Look at Exodus, the 3rd chapter with me. In Exodus chapter 3, there God reveals Himself to Moses in the burning bush. And I'm reading in Exodus chapter 3 and in verse 14. In Exodus 3 and verse 14, there we read, God said to Moses, Exodus 3:14, "I am who I am. God is eternal. That is part of His nature. That is part of who He is. That's why He calls Himself the I am who I am. God is uncaused. He is not an effect. He is, in fact, the cause of everything. So God has no need to have been caused or created because He lives outside of time and space where the laws of cause and effect do not operate. God is eternal. He has never been created. So asking somebody who created God is a wrong sort of question. It's like asking, have you seen that married bachelor? Oh, wait. Have you ever seen a square circle? Who caused God doesn't work, it doesn't fit. God is not subject to cause and effect, but the universe most certainly is. The universe is a natural phenomenon. By the way, you know that for a long time atheists tried to say the universe was infinitely old. That it had always been. Why'd they say that? Right there. Wanted to get out of that. It's always been here. No cause. It's just infinite like God. So there we go. But you know what? The assertion that the universe was infinite and infinitely old bumped into science. Einstein's theory. Astronomers building on that, they have proven conclusively our universe had a beginning point. Atheists hate that because if it had a beginning point, then it had a beginner. So every house has a builder. Who built this house? What's the beginning point? Who began it? Who caused this enormous effect? In fact, as we're talking about creation, that leads to this second proof. In fact, as we look at our creation, as we look at the creation that God has made, we see that our planet is, in fact, fine-tuned for life. Look with me in Genesis. Let's just read a little bit there in the text. Let's get a little bit of Genesis chapter 1. In Genesis chapter 1, sometimes when we start talking about the beginning of the universe, people act like that was some kind of random accident. But that's not at all what we see in Genesis. In Genesis 1, read with me in verse 3. God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw that the light was good. Now in Genesis 1, 6, God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. Let's separate the waters from the waters. Now in Genesis 1, 9, God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place. Let dry land appear. God called the dry land earth, and the waters were gathered together. God saw that it was good. God said, let earth sprout vegetation and plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit. What you see in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 is progression and order and careful fine-tuning of creation so that life can exist. This is certainly something where science stands to support our case and our cause. Because the more science examines life, the more they've come to realize there are a huge number of factors that have to all come together in exactly the right way, in exactly the right place, in exactly the right time, or you can't have life. You got to have the right galaxy. You got to have the right sun. You got to have the right this. It's all got to be just right, or there would be no life at all. For example, in the atom itself, there are four fundamental forces that have to do with the way the atom is bound up. You can read lots about this kind of stuff. There's the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force. Physicists talk about this all day long. If those forces vary by 1%, our universe would be entirely made up of hydrogen, no life. Or if they vary 1% the other way, there'd be no hydrogen at all, still no life. If the forces were weaker, atoms couldn't stick together. Then you can't have molecules. Then you can't have life. It just goes on and on from there. For example, what about gravity? If the gravity in the stars is not strong enough, then the stars won't ever burn hot enough to ignite. But if it's too strong, then they burn too hot and they just all burn up. And it goes on from there. Like, how great is it that we have Jupiter circling the sun as we're circling the sun? So I don't care whether Jupiter's... Sure you do. Jupiter's an enormous planet with a huge gravitational pull. As it's cycling out there, it sucks in comets and asteroids that would hit the Earth and obliterate life here. It serves as a giant vacuum cleaner. Pretty great to have it out there, isn't it? And what about where we are in relation to the sun? Don't be too close. Get kind of toasty. Don't want to be too far. get kind of chilly. The earth needs to be between 90 million to 100 million miles of the sun, or we'd all die one way or the other. And then you need the earth to be tilted on its axis just right, or you'd have extremes of weather that would prohibit life. All of that is to say that one astronomer estimated the odds of a life-friendly planet getting all those things right, just randomly occurring. He estimates those odds as being 1 in 10 to the 129th power. That's a 1 followed by 129 zeros. 1 in 10 to the 129th power. That number is pronounced, I wrote this down, 1,000 quintillion, 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 quintillion. Those are longer odds than the Rangers winning the World Series. Those are long odds. You can't just say, oh, it just kind of sort of happened. One expert in the Wall Street Journal wrote the following: today there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, and every single one of them has to be perfectly met or the whole thing falls apart. So what we're saying here is that the universe is here. That's number one. But now we're saying, not only are we here, it seems like everything is just exactly right for life to exist and grow and thrive. Now, do you know how atheists handle that? The new argument that atheists are making is that not only did the universe arise spontaneously out of nothing, that billions of universes have actually arisen out of nothing. So when you have billions and billions and billions of universes, eventually one of them is going to get it all just right and life is going to exist there. Aren't we lucky? You got to wonder if these guys play the lottery. They love these long odds. If a fellow was dealing cards and every hand he dealt himself four aces, how many times would that go by till the other poker playing buddies would say, we won't look at that deck of cards. We think you're cheating. Oh, no, wait. Don't you know? There's billions of universes and billions of card games. So it just had to happen somewhere where four aces just keep coming up every time. No one would buy that. That's just four aces. That's nothing compared to the infinite complexity of the universe that we live in, which is fine-tuned for life. Which leads to this third evidence for God, and that is the evidence of intelligent design. Let's just start thinking about cause and effect and work with that a little bit. If, for example, you jump in a police car and you go out on a call and they found a body, that would be a cause. Okay, that's an effect. So now we're looking at the cause, right? This body's an effect. What are we looking for there? We're looking to see some purpose and intention. Because death by natural causes looks very different than somebody who's been murdered with a handgun. So you see purpose and intention, design going on there. That's not just for police and crime. If a car is wrecked, the insurance sends an investigator. They look at the wreck. Was that a random accident or was this done on purpose? Archaeologists do that kind of thing. They find an interesting rock. Well, is it just a rock? It just happens to be here? Or was this an arrowhead that's been chipped and has been crafted? That's what we're talking about when we start talking about design. We're looking to see if there is intelligent, purposeful cause. The intelligent design movement says we can look at our world, we can look at creation, and we can see, does it show design? Does it show purpose? Does it show intent? Does it show that there's been a designer? You want an illustration of that? Well, you got two of them right here. Everybody is looking at me with their eyes. We just take that for granted. Yet the processes that are happening right now for you to see me and to see in your peripheral vision and to see color and to see depth and dimension, all of those things, making that work is enormously complicated. For example, did you know that your eyes twitch all the time? They actually do. There is something called the vestibulo-ocular reflex that makes your eyes twitch in tiny little movements all the time. So it says, why is my eye twitching? It's your own version of Steadicam. If your eyes didn't do that when you ran, when you walk, your vision would get all blurry because you're moving your eyes around. But there are muscles that counteract that by moving your eyes in very slight ways against those movements so that you can still see, even when you move your head. That's amazing. And there's lots of that stuff just in your eye. For example, do you want to talk about blinking, irrigation, lubrication, cleaning, and protection? That happens every time we blink. The whole eyelid system to make the rest of the eye work. You blink 4,200,000 times a year. And everybody just did it once right there for it. All of that to make the eye work. And there's still more on top of that. There's lenses and cornea and the retina. And don't forget, just because you've got an eye, that doesn't do you any good if it doesn't connect to a brain that can process that image and interpret what you are seeing. What about that looks random? What about any of that looks like, oh, it just happened to arise that way? In your eye, there are too many systems that you need to all come together at one time or the whole thing wouldn't work. That shows what? That shows design and a designer. In fact, that's the argument made in the 139th Psalm. If you could find Psalm 139 in your Bible, please. In Psalm 139, David here says, in Psalm 139 and verse 14, in Psalm 139 and verse 14, David says, I praise you. Psalm 139, 14, I praise you for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. So the universe is here, and we're placed in exactly the right place in the universe to be sustained and grow. And then everything about our life shows that we've been designed so that we can live and grow. Atheists can deny all of that all that they want, but the evidence shows there is a designer. Which please brings me to the last and final evidence for the existence of God. Maybe this is the easiest one of all. And that is that actually God's been seen. Sometimes we make a lot of arguments about the existence of God and overlook this one. If you'd find Romans 1, Romans 1 mentions and discusses how creation forms a basis for believing in God. And so the things that I've said this morning about the law of cause and effect, about our planet being fine-tuned, and about intelligent design demanding a designer, those things are absolutely true. That's why Paul says in Romans 1, verse 19, what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them, for His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So talk about creation, talk about the universe, talk about cause and effect, talking about the eye, that works. That's a go. But if you met somebody who didn't believe in watches, oh, come on. How can you possibly have a device on your wrist that tells time? I mean, you know how small all that stuff would be? I just don't believe, oh, that's hogwash. I don't believe in watches. How would you answer that? Well, you could make an argument about intelligent design, those sorts of things, but probably what most of us would do is say, it's a watch. Look. Maybe the best evidence for the existence of God is that you can look at Jesus Christ and see God. We know God exists because God came here and visited the planet in the person of Jesus the Christ. In John 8, please, in John 8 and verse 58, this is exactly what Jesus claims. In John chapter 8 and verse 58, Jesus said to the Jews, truly, truly, I say unto you, John 8 and verse 58, truly, truly, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. The greatest argument for God is Jesus the Christ. Because if Jesus is God, then God has been seen. He came here. And the New Testament is the record of God's visit here. If you believe the New Testament, then it's telling you God is and God has been seen. It's telling you, in fact, what God did when He came here, that He offered Himself as the sacrifice for our sins. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, those four books say, look, there is God in the flesh, Jesus Christ. And in fact, the rest of the New Testament records how lives were changed by the coming of God to this earth. What that means is we really need to ask the question, is the Bible reliable? Because it's telling us about God, and it's telling us that God exists, and it tells us who God is. Is this book reliable? Can we still believe the Bible? That is exactly what we want to talk about next month. In the meantime, even though atheism is on the rise in America, and there are more university clubs and atheists regularly on the news pushing their books and shouting there with all venom and vitriol against believers, we need to remember, this isn't about what everybody believes. We don't believe in God because most Americans believe in God. And we're not going to stop believing in God if most Americans don't believe in God. We believe in God because the evidence overwhelmingly shows there is a God. These four arguments and a host of others demand the existence of God. We believe in God because it is true that God exists. It is right. That conforms to reality. That is the way things really are. The data, the evidence, what we can see, what we can understand, what we can reason and infer from leads us to conclude without a doubt, there is a God. He is alive. And that's why the Bible begins, in the beginning, God. He is the beginning of everything for us. Now we're going to sing this invitation song now to give you an opportunity to think a little bit about this and to consider where you are in your walk with God, who most certainly is. Remember how we talked about how this makes a difference? What you believe about God determines everything about you and who you are, how you act, how you behave, what you're living for, what you're doing. It's not enough to say, okay, yeah, okay, I guess God's here. How are you responding to the God who is and who made you?